This is the best of public radio from NHPR. I'm Andrew Perella.
We live in a small island stone nation without color, under gray clouds and wind, distant the unlimited ocean, acute...
As we tried to make sense of the senseless this month, we heard echoes of the past, of talking heads pontificating, even conjecturing without much thought. They might have done better to crack open a book of poetry and heap balm upon the open wound instead of trying to pry it further open. If they had, they might have found The 19th of April by Lucy Larcom.
The passion flower of 76 is bursting into bloom. Dear is the time of roses, when earth to joy is wed, and garden plot and meadow wear one generous flush of red. But now in dearer beauty, to her ancient colors true, blooms the old town of Boston in red and white and blue. Along the whole awakening north are those bright emblems spread. A summer noon of patriotism is burning overhead. No party badges flaunting now, no word of clique or clan, but up for God and Union is the shout of every man.
If they'd looked around, they might also have found An April Day by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, or countless other poems, like Emerson's Boston.
The sea returning day by day restores the worldwide mart. So let each dweller on the bay fold Boston in his heart, till these echoes be choked with snows, or over the town blue ocean flows.
These give great insight into the identity of Boston and its citizens. But more than that, they might have provided a modicum of comfort for those looking for answers that did not yet exist. Poets know something about snatching comfort from the jaws of loss.
But of course, making something beautiful out of it is a way of dealing with the horror.
For former U.S. poet laureate Donald Hall, his horror was the death of his wife, poet Jane Kenyon. He spoke with NHPR in 1996, about a year after his wife passed away.
Since Jane died, life is miserable without her, and the grief is extraordinary. I've taken consolation all my life from poets who've written in the past, even the distant, distant past. So did Jane. I said, take some consolation from some of her own poems about grief. But also, there's a wonderful 17th century poem by Henry King that I've loved for years and read aloud whenever I lost somebody dear to me. And it's a poem about the death of his young wife.
King's poem reads, "Dear loss, since thy untimely fate, my task has been to meditate on thee. On thee, thou art the book, the library whereon I look, though almost blind. For thee, loved clay, I languish out, not live the day."
There's a poem by Thomas Hardy that I adore called During Wind and Rain. It's terribly beautiful. And what it says in four stanzas, each of them saying the same thing, is people have a lot of fun together in their families when they're young, but then they get old and die. And we knew this already, and it's a miserable thing.
There's no dearth of poems waxing lyrical about the tragedy of the human condition. That's the poet's meat and potatoes, in fact. But Hall argues that it's not as depressing as it all may seem. A poem like Hardy's is enormously
beautiful. The poem is enormously beautiful. And when I read the poem, I'm full of joy. I take consolation from them, not because they console me over a death or tell me everything's really all right, but because I have the companionship of grief, of extreme grief.
Is it as simple as misery loves company? Or is it that with profound loss, whether the death of a loved one or an explosion in one of our cities, our loss is in some regard intangible? The poem addresses that.
And that companionship, that human companionship, is something that I value enormously. And of course, in my own poems, I wish to be the companion of others who are in the same place I'm in.
In the wake of disaster, poetry can provide solace almost as powerful as human contact. As we grapple with the loss disaster leaves us with, a stanza is a gift. But don't thank him. Hall doesn't write his poems for the benefit of society, at least not at first.
That's not why I write them. I don't write them as an act of altruism. Mm-hmm. But if I write them in my situation, and if I write them well enough, they will, in fact, be for other people, as the poems I've been mentioning are for me. I write them to get it off my chest. I write it to express it as well as I can. The extent of the grief, the extent of the love, and what I've lost. We live in a small island stone nation without color, under gray clouds and wind, distant the unlimited ocean, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, without seagulls or palm trees, without vegetation or animal life, only barnacles and lead-colored moss that darkens when months do. Hours, days, weeks, months, weeks, days, hours. The year endures without punctuation. February without ice, winter, sleet. Snow melts and recovers, but nothing. Without thaw, although cold streams hurtle, no snowdrop or crocus rises, no yellow, no bright leaves of maple without autumn. No spring, no summer, no autumn, no winter, no rain, no peony, thunder, no wood thrush. The book is 1,000 pages without commas, without mice, maple leaves, windstorms, no castles, no plazas, no flags, no parrots, pain, vomit, neuropathy, morphine, nightmare, vincristin, RSC, cytoxin, VP16. Loss of memory, loss of language, losses, foamless, unmitigated, sea without sea, delirium, with marks of petechiae, PCP, multiple blisters of herpes zoster, and how are you doing today? I am doing. One afternoon, say the sun comes out, moss takes on greenishness, leaves fall, the market opens, a loaf of bread, a sparrow. A bony dog wanders back, sniffing a lath. It might be possible to take up a pencil, unwritten stanzas taken up and touched, beautiful, terrible sentences unuttered. The sea, unrelenting wave, gray, the sea, flotsam without islands, broken crates, block after block, the same house, the mall. No cathedral, no hobo jungle, the same women and men. They long to drink hay fields without dog or semicolon or village square, without monkey or lily, without garlic.
Donald Hall reading his poem, Without. Frankly, poetry has a long history with radio. Before our obsession with archives, with saving anything and everything for posterity, before Twitter went into the Library of Congress, before that, radio and poetry shared an ephemeral quality, which made them kin. There aren't many radio producers who create poetry with a microphone, but Sean Hurley's one of them. He's been running down and learning about a particular road near his house for a while now. This road was the subject of the 1973 book The Road Through Sandwich Notch by Elizabeth Yates, which, more than anything else, helped secure the road's preservation status as a part of the White Mountain National Forest. Sean sent this reflection.
And so I was running along an old road, in new shoes, over fresh snow, listening to an old radio show about an old writer who had just died. But long ago.
Tonight's show is about Jack Kerouac, and if you don't know who Kerouac was, he died today.
That's storytelling radio pioneer Gene Shepherd, talking near the end of October 1969. The road I was on was Sandwich Notch Road, a rickety 9-mile waltz of mostly dirt that wanders up and down and left and right in the swinging manner of a kite over the mountains that lie between Campton and Sandwich.
But Kerouac was primarily a digger, a true digger. He dug just everything. He dug the climate, he dug the landscape, he dug the sky.
He would have dug the road I was on, an old shipwreck of a road, an old fallen down tree of a road. In its heyday, in the 1800s, there were 300 families that lived here. Along the main stretch, where it really is, there's no one now. and all that remains of the people who once lived here are the stones they moved. Their dug cellars and rock walls, their gravestones dealt to the high, hidden groves just off the road. There's the pulpit rock upon which Reverend Joseph Meador used to stand above his Quaker congregation, his voice rolling off the cliffs. There's even a sign inscribed on a rock that advertises a general store ahead.
P. Wentworth, 6 miles, 1838.
And whenever I see it, I am suddenly heading toward P. Wentworth's general store, forever 6 miles ahead and 175 years in the past.
Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying to you that Kerouac was a great novelist. I am saying this, though, about him, that I think that what he said is a thing that hasn't been said by many people who wrote in America. He wrote about the land and the country.
Kerouac used the glass of the land to find his way. A gnarled tree in front of a farmhouse told the first part of the story of the family who lived there. Shepherd's compass was time. He liked to tell stories of his childhood. He liked to imagine archaeologists from the future sifting through a mysterious rubble of 8-track tapes and disposable, eternal silverware.
So one night I came in and there was a letter there and a package. And it was the galley copy of On the Road. And there was a note in it from Kerouac. And it said, I want you to read this. I think you might dig it. And incidentally, you're one of the characters in the novel. So I read it, and I immediately, this was before it came out, I recognized it for what it was.
As fellow travelers of the incantation, Shepherd and Kerouac cut themselves on the long riff in the Hail Mary of improvisation. Pure waiting air for Shepherd, blank teletype paper for Kerouac. But what drew them close was a natural way of seeing. For as fancy as both could be, they were both primitives. Like children, they were primarily beholders. Anyone who explores this road will end up hip deep in time, swimming in the land. There is no who, there is no what, there is only where, there is only when. There is time and the land, and the only way to see it is to behold it. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
And On the Road map was one long red line called Route 6 that led from the tip of Cape Cod to Ely, Nevada.
Youth, Day, Old Age, and Night by Walt Whitman. Youth, large, lusty, loving, youthful of grace, force, fascination. Do you know that old age may come after you with equal grace, force, fascination? Day full blown and splendid, day of the immense sun, action, ambition, laughter. The night follows close with millions of suns in sleep and restoring darkness.
6-year-old Gareth reciting Walt Whitman's Youth, Day, Old Age, and Night from producer Aaron Sanders.
The last train is nearly due. The underground is closing soon. And in the dark, deserted station, restless in anticipation, a man waits in the shadows. His restless eyes leap and scratch at all that they can touch and catch. Hidden deep within his pocket, safe within his silent socket, he holds a colored crayon. Now from the tunnel's stony womb, the carriage rides to meet the groom and opens wide and welcome doors, but he hesitates, then withdraws deeper in the shadows.
As William Hazlitt reminded us at the beginning, poetry is all that is worth remembering in life. We asked folks to tell us about their memories of how a poem had affected their life. And Roger Martin from Harrisville, New Hampshire, remembered hearing a poem that helped him return to civilian life after a tour of duty in Vietnam.
Dulce et decorum est by Wilfred Owen. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs. You know, the state of the country was, it was a far different place in 1970. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on. I had just been discharged from the U.S. Army and moved back to Pennsylvania, where I grew up, and enrolled in Millersville State College. I guess serendipitously, one of the first courses that I enrolled for was a survey of poetry course. I recall walking in and sitting down and thinking, well, here we are back at school, and this professor came in sandals and proceeded to sit on top of the teacher's desk and without a word began reading that poem. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face. It was so unexpected because I think for a soldier, at least for this soldier, when I came back from Vietnam, it was as, unless it was another soldier who was there, you couldn't talk about it. You didn't want to think about it. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer. And I think we probably all thought that we were alone in this. That moment told me I wasn't alone, that other soldiers in other places had gone through the same thing. And it goes right back to the Iliad, and you realize this is just a common thread that it's human reactions and emotions haven't changed in 2,000 years. But it's just the weapons have changed. And that's, I think, why I consider it sort of a lifesaver, because all of a sudden I had some place I could go to begin to process them. I just felt blessed to be in that spot at that time. To children ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. It's the Roman expression, it is fitting and proper to die for one's country. I would say it is very seldom fitting and it is very seldom proper.
In a minute, we'll check in with some folks who've been improving New Hampshire's street cred among slam poets, and we'll find some verse in unusual places. In the meantime, share your thoughts with us. Tell us about a poem that's made an impact on your life, or what you think poetry's place is in our cultural landscape. Join the discussion on nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook. I'm Andrew Perella. You're listening to the best of public radio from NHPR.